It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Israel barred two U.S. representatives from the country yesterday after pressure via Twitter from President Trump. The story has been changing since then. We'll talk about the precedent it could set and what it says about the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. First, it's Food Friday, and we're looking at the different ways to use chickpeas. You might also know them as garbanzo beans or a few other names. No matter what you call them, there's a lot you can use them for: salads, soups, baking, and hummus. Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Well, I use the words chickpeas and garbanzo beans interchangeably, but I've always wondered, like, wait, is there a thing that's one and a thing that's the other?
In that instance, not really. There are different kinds of chickpeas. What you'll most find, especially dried in American groceries, is the kabuli type. They're the largest. They're beige. What's known around the world more often is the desi type of chickpea, slightly smaller and more yellow in color. And so it's possible that you might find those more in Mexican groceries, but they're really the same thing. There is such a thing as a green chickpea as well, simply a younger version of either one of the two. Very popular in Indian cuisine because they taste more like green peas. There is one other that I've not been able to find in this country. There is such a thing as black chickpeas. They're used in Indian cooking. They're a little bit smaller than a chickpea, reddish brown, very, very tough. Every Indian cook I know says you have to cook them in a pressure cooker to get them edible.
Now, the choice most of us will face if we want to make something with chickpeas, we'll get into what we can do with them in a bit, but the choice most of us are going to see is dry or canned. Is there a rule of thumb for when we use which?
Canned, obviously. Those are already cooked and very, very soft. Nothing wrong with canned chickpeas. I use them all the time. You will want to rinse them off, though, because they are going to have a little more sodium, and rinsing them off will take care of some of that extra salt. If you're somebody who knows how to use that chickpea water that's in the can, what's now called aquafaba, we'll probably get into that a little bit later because that's a completely different animal. But if you're someone who wants to use that, go ahead and save that water. So canned chickpeas are fine, a lot softer. I tend to use canned chickpeas when I'm going to be using them in something that's hot. Occasionally, I will use them in soup. I love making a really basic pasta sauce with canned chickpeas, just a little bit of water and a lot of olive oil to make them very, very soft. If I'm going to have chickpeas around for salads or for tucking into sandwiches or even for roasting, I personally prefer to take the time, soak your chickpeas the night before you're going to boil them, and then boil them down. I've discovered a really great trick to take the boiling down to 20, sometimes 40 minutes, and that's to add a teaspoon of baking soda to the cooking water. Other than that, you're going to want to boil a pre-soaked batch of chickpeas, maybe an hour, possibly an hour and a half. It all depends on how firm you want them. For roasting, for salads, I do prefer having a firmer texture. Even if I'm going to blitz them in the food processor and make hummus, I like having a firmer texture. And again, less sodium. You've got more control when you're using your dried chickpeas. And just really rough on the math, it's also a little bit cheaper to use the dried rather than the canned.
Talking to Lori Skelton on this edition of Food Friday. We're cooking with chickpeas, a.k.a. garbanzo beans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite recipe? Do you have a question about what to do with them, how to cook them? Do you have a favorite way to eat or make hummus? And do you use the water in the chickpea can for this aquafaba thing? This is weird. We'll get to that in a bit. Call 800-642-1234. But let's get to some primo chickpea action here, Lori, with hummus. You brought in a couple of your home science recipes here today.
Because the whole idea of my doing a chickpea Food Friday was somebody came to me and said, can you please teach Wisconsin Public Radio how to make hummus the right way?
Because we've been dropping the ball. We've been walking the state with really subpar hummus for our listeners. We're going to fix that today.
Well, here's the scary thing, or the delightful thing. I've talked to a lot of chefs. I've read a lot of blogs, and there is a little bit of a, well, almost a Mason-Dixon line when it comes to how do you do your hummus. I've learned that in Israel, hummus is eaten warm. It's a little bit runny, but it's also blended a lot longer than we usually blend ours. It's eaten for breakfast with a spoon. You almost don't have – you can ask for pita chips on the side, but you're basically scooping this in as though you were eating porridge. Hummus, I personally like having tahini in mine, and I'm told that that's the traditional way to do it, even though the Arab word for chickpea is hummus. Hmm. But your basic recipe is you take your chickpeas – throw them in the food processor with onion, maybe, garlic, probably, lemon, pretty much, and then, of course, you want olive oil in there. If you want tahini, you put that in there, and you're going to want to blitz this for at least 5 minutes. What a lot of us see in the store these days is basic chickpeas that have been blitz with maybe just a little tahini. The interest will come from what gets put on top of them, whether it's toasted pinoli, pine nuts, or in some cases you can get very, very fancy. In Lebanon, you can top your hummus with ground lamb that's been spiced. I saw one recipe for pomegranate molasses and roasted quail.
Wow.
So it can be as simple or as fancy as you like, but however you serve it, there's going to be somebody at your table who's going to say, that's not the way you do it, which can land you into some really great discussions as, okay, why do you do it your way?
Or I just don't invite them back. Now, people, you can buy at stores packaged hummus and they'll be like, you know, red peppers mixed in, or yeah. I saw a picture of like chocolate hummus. I don't know. People blend a lot of things into the hummus. You are opposed to that. That's going to get you yelling at people. The creativity comes with the stuff, like you were saying, that you put on top of it.
I think so. I like having that relatively blank canvas, and then you can get creative with your toppings. You can also use more toppings that way if something isn't already blended in. That said, if you have the chickpeas already done and say maybe you've got half a cup of boiled beets left over from a couple of nights ago, they're about to go spare, you want to blend that into your hummus just for your own personal enjoyment. I got no problem with that.
But don't inflict it on Lori.
Well, I will definitely take a bite, but okay. I will be looking for other things as well. The one thing you have over your pre-packaged hummus in the store, there are preservatives. There's an awful lot more sodium, and a lot of commercial hummuses out there don't use olive oil. They use soybean oil, which is not as good a fat to put in your body.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Vani is with us in Glendale. Vani, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about?
Oh, well, first of all, I was listening about that brown, blackish, small variety of dried chickpeas that are available at any Indian store.
Okay.
And yes, they do take a little bit longer, but yes.
How do you use them, Vandi?
You can make a curry with it, which is what normally we do. And you can use them in salads, boil and keep it. And then you can just make a dry roasted snack.
Okay.
It has to be boiled first, and then you bake off all the water, and then you heat up a little oil, add a little bit of cumin seeds, and add these chickpeas and salt and a little bit of cumin powder and chili powder to the taste, and they're... Put them in a bowl and eat them with a spoon.
That sounds great, Vani.
I know one recipe I ran across says they're a really good curry accompaniment with golden raisins. Have you ever tried that?
That is not something. No, I have not tried that. But like I said, most Indians like to eat curry as curry without the raisins or anything sweet added to it.
Okay.
Gotcha. Thank you so much, Vani, for calling in and sharing that. I've tried making that chickpea snack, but I do it in the oven, Lori. I've tossed chickpeas in oil and spices and bake them in the oven. They never get quite as crunchy as I want, and I'm doing that with canned. I wonder if I'd be better off with dry, boiled, maybe not overboiled in this case.
I have better luck when I'm roasting chickpeas. I have better luck using ones that I have boiled ahead of time. Lovely thing about that is if you boil a pot of chickpeas on Sunday, go ahead and throw them in the refrigerator and just let them sit there and then use them all week. You can, you don't have to do a whole batch of roasted or salad or anything. Chickpeas will keep in the refrigerator after you've boiled the dried ones well over a week. So yes, toss them 400-degree oven, toss them with some olive oil, your spices. I know some people that even take a packet of ranch dressing powder and sprinkle that on their chickpeas. And I mean, perfect Wisconsin snack, wouldn't you say?
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Lori Skelton about how to use chickpeas or garbanzo beans in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make your own hummus? Do you have a favorite way to use chickpeas in soups, entrees, snacks, whatever, salads? Have you tried to use chickpea flour ever? Or do you ever use the water from the canned chickpeas? This is a thing. We'll get into this. Call 800-642-1234. Or if you have a question, 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our Food Friday conversation with WPR's Lori Skelton, talking about cooking with chickpeas. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your favorite way to use chickpeas or garbanzo beans. Do you have a hummus recipe you like to make at home? Do you have a question for Lori about what to do with them? Have you ever tried using this stuff? It's called aquafaba. It's just the chickpea water. People use it as a substitute for egg whites. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Anthony is with us in Mauston. Anthony, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about, Anthony?
So my family and I, we are plant-based, and we miss eggs an awful lot. And we found a nice little recipe online where we basically blend up dry chickpeas, and it makes an awful noise, but you get those to a fine powder and you put them in the skillet with some oil, and it actually has a scrambled eggs texture. Just add salt, pepper, or green onion, whatever, and it works for us.
Yep. You can get chickpea flour already ground, so you don't have to kill your appliances to try it. And yes, I've heard that Indians will scramble that flour with ginger and make a kind of scrambled egg. So it sounds amazing. I'm glad to know somebody's doing it.
And Anthony, thanks for the call. That takes us to a couple things. I mentioned this aquafaba, Lori. It's a big thing, you tell me. Using the liquid, it works like egg whites, kind of?
Exactly. Last year, the British version of Great British Bake Off, or baking show, if you will, what we didn't see in this country is they did a vegan week. And the technical challenge was make meringues, make a pavlova with aquafaba, where you take the water that's in a can of chickpeas, you throw it in your stand mixer with the whisk, and you whip the blazes out of it, and it acts like an egg white. I've tried this, and I have yet to master it, but part of my problem is I was trying to make a fairly crisp meringue. I was trying to make my favorite dessert, which is a pavlova, which is supposed to be marshmallowy in the middle and crisp on the outside. I can't quite get that texture. That said, what I'm seeing online more and more, if you're vegan, this is how you make your lemon meringue pie, your baked Alaska. You can make chocolate mousse. You can make nougat. You can make a kind of buttercream with aquafaba, marshmallow fluff, apparently. This is how you can make an egg white cocktail again if you don't eat eggs. You can make a kind of mozzarella cheese. You can make vegan butter. But I'm not able to do all of this yet. So if anybody out there is, I want to hear from you.
800-642-1234. Hearing about that pavlova is making my mouth water. Back to your calls now. Shane is with us in Eau Claire. Shane, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Shane?
So I do like making a lot of kinds of hummus. I got to say that when I get quote-unquote exciting, I just kind of mix in different kinds of beans. Black bean has been popular with my family. But I had a question about falafel. My brother and I were trying to make some the other day, and we've had some mixed results. But, you know, I've also haven't been able to find maybe a recipe that you can bake instead of just frying. So I was hoping maybe you'd have some tips and pointers on how to make falafel well.
And Shane, I want to ask, are you using, I've only done this with a mix. Like you can buy a box or bag or whatever falafel mix. Are you actually making your own mix?
Trying to go straight.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
And Shane, I'm sorry. I have yet to perfect this as well. I don't deep fry a lot because mostly I'm cooking for me during the week. It's not worth it to me to get the kitchen that messy just to deep fry for one. And you're right. If you're not using a mix, that stuff can fall apart. And baking it, I'm told it's possible. I've yet to perfect it. They end up really, really tasty, but they're very, very flat and a little bit oily.
Thanks. Good luck, Shane. When I've made it a mix, what I usually do is just pan fry it, so I'm not immersing it, and I just kind of like make little patties that I toss.
Yeah.
It's not quite like getting it at the falafel restaurant, though.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's a lovely thing if you can make it yourself. Again, if somebody's got the secret, call in and let us know. But that tends to be something I let somebody else make for me.
Thanks a lot for that call. It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us. We're cooking with chickpeas. Find some recipes. There's a hummus. There's a couple other things. A fake tuna salad made with chickpeas. We'll
That's
get to that
really
maybe in
good.
A bit. That is at WPR.org/Food Friday. Spicy beans with wilted greens we put back up there. But back to your calls now. Brad is on the line in Eau Claire. Brad, hello.
Hi, thank you. I love your show today on the chickpeas.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering if your guest has ever had any luck with a vegan mayonnaise with the aquafaba.
That's actually something that I've not tried myself, but more people have told me that that's how they got into using aquafaba, is a vegan mayo. They do say they probably give it a little more seasoning than they would their standard mayonnaise. I know a lot of people want white pepper in that, probably some Dijon mustard, a really sharp white wine vinegar. So you're probably going to season this a little bit more than you would just your standard egg mayo. But that's a really good way to get started. You blitz all of that up in your blender. It takes probably no more than a minute and a half. You may have to give that a little bit of extra aeration because those aren't technically egg whites, but that's a really great way to start.
And Brad, have you done this yourself?
I have done it. I've had fairly good luck with it. I've done it in a food processor. And, you know, the technique is you have to be careful putting the oil in. You know, it takes quite a bit of oil.
Right.
But I do it about 3 minutes in my food processor, and I do use some Dijon mustard and some lemon juice, and you have to kind of spice it up a little bit. But I have had very good luck with the vegan mayonnaise with the aquafaba.
Okay, great. Good to know.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Brad. We'll go to Jody with us now in Stoughton. Jody, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The previous caller, one of them actually touched on something, and it was about the flour, the dried and the ground-up chickpeas or garbanzo beans.
Right.
I have tried making hummus, which I could eat every day, from the can and cooking my own, and I'm never happy with the texture. So then I saw this in the store one day, and I thought, why can't I try it with this? It's actually sitting on my counter as we speak. And I'm making it this weekend, but does that lend itself to that?
I've never heard of using a flour in any kind of hummus. Might I suggest before you try tossing that in there, I take it you want to do that to make the texture a little bit thicker?
No, the ground chickpeas themselves, the chickpea flour.
I don't think you can do a hummus with flour. I think you really do need the chickpeas for that. I really think it comes down to aerating the actual legume.
Well, if you can prove us wrong, Jody, make it and send samples. We'll try them out here.
Absolutely.
We'll go to Mike with us now in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. So I got a little recipe I use for my nephew who's has nut allergies. And I take my canned chickpeas. And I dry them out overnight, just leave them out on the counter, let them dry out a little bit. And then I coat them with a little bit of honey and a little bit of cardamom powder, and then I put them in the food dehydrator and let them sit for about 5-6 hours. And I've got these wonderful, crunchy little snacks that are the equivalent of, well, not quite the equivalent of a peanut, of a honey-roasted peanut, but
honey and cardamom. Oh.
Yes.
Mike?
And the cardamom I add, because I'm a cardamom addict, and I put it in just about everything. It's like my chili is almost always cardamom. But it adds just a little bit of, pizzazz to it. The mix with the sweet of the honey, a little savory with the sweet of the honey and the chickpea, and it's great for those that have peanut allergies.
Mike, I know what I'm going to be making for dessert this weekend. Thank you so much. That sounds brilliant.
Yeah, what a great idea, Mike. Let's quickly touch on one of the other recipes we've got up, the chickpeas in place of tuna, Lori, in our last minute or so.
It's not going to fool anybody who really wants tuna. But again, if you're looking for a way to, say, get a little bit more creative in your kitchen, if you've got vegan family members and you don't know what to make for them, this sort of tuna salad is a really good way to get started. Again, you've got Dijon mustard in there, scallion, celery, a little bit of maple syrup. If you've got nori, that dried seaweed, you'll want to crumble a little bit of that in there, some red onions, some capers. Put an open face with a little bit of avocado on the top. I guarantee it's an amazing sandwich.
But don't pretend it's tuna. You're not fooling anybody.
But it
sounds really good on its own terms.
It sounds amazing. Let's put it this way. We've got it up on the website, and tuna is in quotation.
Quotes. Excellent. Well, it's been a lot of fun, as always, Lori. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Lori Skelton, classical music host at WPR, a regular here on Food Friday. You can find some of the chickpea recipes we've been talking about, including a hummus recipe and a chickpea salad, at WPR.org/Food Friday. Also that chickpea tuna. I'm air quoting around tuna there. Israel announced yesterday it would bar two Democratic U.S. representatives from entering the country. The two representatives at the center of the news are Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. Both lawmakers are Muslim and have been critical of Israel's Palestinian policies. The move to deny Omar and Tlaib's entry to the country came soon after President Trump made a statement on Twitter saying Israel should block the representatives from visiting. Israel later backtracked some and said Representative Tlaib could visit the West Bank on humanitarian grounds to visit her 90-year-old grandmother. Tlaib rejected that invitation. John Hudson is a reporter for The Washington Post who covers diplomacy and national security. John, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, great to be here.
Well, it's kind of an unusual diplomatic and domestic situation here. Can you start us off with an overview of why the Representative Tlaib and Omar were saying they were going to be in Israel and Palestine?
Right. So they were going to make a trip to meet with a number of Palestinians, especially Palestinians affected by the aid cuts that the Trump administration put in place after the Palestinians have walked away from the actually refused to negotiate with the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who was trying to work out this peace deal. As you know, sort of the background, the Trump administration has done a number of things in advance of this peace deal that has been called the deal of the century. They have moved the embassy, the United States embassy, to Jerusalem, recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and has also withdrawn lots of funding to the Palestinians and shut down their consulate. So the Palestinians walked away from the table. Essentially, these lawmakers wanted to make a visit, the president encouraged the Israeli government to not let them visit. And Netanyahu, who is a close ally of the president, decided a reversal from his previous decision, said that the lawmakers could no longer enter Israel.
Well, let's step back on that. Is this an unusual situation where you have an American president encouraging another country to bar members of Congress from visiting?
Yeah, absolutely. It's unprecedented. No one can really point to a historical circumstance whereby the president encourages a foreign power to limit the travel rights of a domestic enemy, domestic opponent is probably the right way to say it. and a member of Congress. But we're talking about a country with regards to Israel that refers to itself as the only democracy in the Middle East. A lot of Democrats objecting to the fact that a democracy does not prevent people from entering the country based on those people's political views, and that's what's happening in Israel right now. The two lawmakers have expressed support for a boycott movement, boycotting Israel, and in exchange, they've been prevented from entering the country.
We've seen a lot of response to this, including from some very pro-Israeli groups in the United States, including, I think, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, or AIPAC, saying, hey, we really disagree with everything these two members of Congress stand for when it comes to Israel, but they encouraged Israel to still allow the visits. Can you talk about some of the range of reaction?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good example. AIPAC is one of the most powerful organizations in Washington, D.C., when it comes to foreign policy. It is an 800-pound gorilla, and AIPAC almost never disagrees with the government of Israel. And so for it to say that this was a decision that was a mistake and criticizing the Israeli government for not letting them in is a pretty massive moment. Basically, you've seen a number of American Jewish organizations that are extremely pro-Israel and reliably pro-Israel have criticized this decision, essentially saying that, for lawmakers that have opposing views with regards to Israel, they should be allowed to come and visit the country. A number of pro-Israel lawmakers who are not by no means allies of Omar and Tlaib have really privately expressed regret about the decision because they feel that it draws sympathy to the cause of Tlaib and Omar.
Talking to John Hudson from the Washington Post, he covers diplomacy and national security, talking about this saga to American members of Congress, barred from visiting Israel with President Trump's encouragement. And now, John, some more wrinkles over the last day. Israel said, hold on, Representative Tlaib could visit her 90-year-old grandmother in the West Bank on humanitarian grounds with some limits as to what she could actually do on the visit. Talk about that part of the story as it's gone on over the last day.
Yeah, it's a fascinating sort of side angle. So the Israelis said that Tlaib could only enter Israel on condition that she promised not to promote any boycotts of Israel while on the trip. Initially, Tlaib signed a document saying she was open to doing this. She took a number of criticisms within the pro-Palestinian community for this. She was in a really difficult place in the sense that she had to balance her desire to visit her grandmother in the West Bank, who's very old, might have been the last opportunities to visit her. And she could do that on the one hand, or she would have to, but if she was going to visit her, she would have to agree to not promote any boycott against Israel, which, of course, is a very strongly held view from her point. Who's very pro-Palestinian cause, very sympathetic with the Palestinian cause. So after thinking about it, she decided that she did not want to agree to be muzzled on this trip and felt like that would be a concession. The Israelis then took the unusual step of actually publishing the letter that she had originally signed when she was going to go along with this agreement to muzzle herself while in Israel. They published that letter, even though she had changed her mind. That prompted some angry statements from the Democratic majorities. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer put out a statement saying it was inappropriate to leak that. He's been the one that has sort of, along with other Democrats, negotiating on her behalf. They were upset at the Israelis for basically criticizing her, saying that she cares more about criticizing Israel than her own grandmother.
Let's step back a little bit now. As you mentioned, this all happens in the backdrop of Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, trying to broker a peace deal, which occurs in the backdrop of a long history of efforts at peace deals. Does this, what we're seeing this week with these two members of Congress, is that something that's going to affect these peace negotiations one way or another? Or is this just going to be a sideshow in the big picture?
Well, it's not going out on a limb to say that this peace agreement has been pretty much dead in the water for several months now. The Israelis, quite frankly, have behind the scenes been pushing for a delayed release. They're not excited about it coming out. The Palestinians feel that they have swallowed so many concessions that that the U.S. is no longer a neutral mediator. And so there weren't a lot of places for this to go. It certainly doesn't strengthen Washington's hand at being perceived as a broker for a peace deal. So in that sense, not much has really changed.
And then looking at domestic politics, some people have worried, some supporters of Israel have worried that this could damage what's mostly been a bipartisan consensus, Democrats and Republicans supporting Israel. What do you see the impact in places like Congress, John?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, in general, it's pretty unprecedented for the Israeli government to deny travel for a member of Congress. That's been widely seen as a big misstep. But you got to remember that there are extremely powerful institutions in Washington that advance a pro-Israel agenda, that are very well financed, that are continuing. They're not going to go away. They're going to still be extremely powerful in influencing, in some cases, dictating America's foreign policy in the Middle East. And so many of these forces believe this was an upset and something that's publicly embarrassing. But those institutions aren't going to go away. And so Congress is still going to be an overwhelmingly pro-Israel organization and when it comes to the universe of opinions there. And Omar and Tlaib and voices that are slightly more skeptical, Senator Bernie Sanders, to a lesser extent, Senator Elizabeth Warren, those voices will be out there, and they're increasing in number. But in general, Congress is still overwhelmingly pro-Israel, and there's not an immediate sign that that's going to subside anytime soon.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yep, happy to be with you.
That's John Hudson, reporter at The Washington Post, who covers diplomacy and national security. He joined us today to talk about Israel's decision to bar U.S. Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib from the country and the U.S.-Israel relationship. Wisconsin has amber alerts for missing kids and silver alerts for missing senior citizens. But what kind of emergency announcements are made when people between 18 and 65 disappear? Well, none for the most part. Texas recently passed legislation that would cover that gap. It came after the disappearance and death of a 19-year-old woman. It'll go into effect on September 1st. Our next guest says it's time for Wisconsin to pick up the ball before a similar tragedy happens here. Owen Robinson is a columnist at the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. Owen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Owen, you had a personal connection to this tragedy in Texas that led to the creation of this law. Can you tell us what happened to this 19-year-old?
Sure. So the young lady you mentioned, her name was Kaylee Mandotti. She was the daughter of an old friend of mine for the last 27 years. And it's a horrible case where she was 19 years old, just out with her boyfriend who had a violent past. And they went out and had a party, or they were at a music festival and ran into an ex-boyfriend. There was an argument, and she was rather forcibly led to her car, and they were gone. And her friends saw it happen. They were concerned. And one of her friends tried to FaceTime her, and the boyfriend picked up and said she wasn't available and hung up. And the next thing you know, Kaylee was found in at a hospital, was dropped off some 70 miles away, beaten, unconscious, and brain dead, and was taken off life support a couple days later. Horrible situation. The police really, I mean, they could do something, but her friends couldn't do much either, because had she been 14 months younger, she would have qualified for an Amber Alert. It was a known person with a violent history, a clearly dangerous situation that they could have put out the alert and maybe could have found them and maybe could have intervened. Would it have saved Kaylee? maybe not, but it might have. And it's something that really hits home for me. Actually, as we speak right now, I'm in the parking lot of one of Wisconsin's fantastic institutions of higher learning, dropping off my 18-year-old daughter for college right now. And this is my third daughter, so I think of her. She's 18 years old. She's out in the world on her own for the first time. As she goes, if she gets in a situation like this where you see where somebody sees her being abducted or forcibly taken away or anything like that, the police can go get involved, but there's no way to issue an alert like you can for a silver alert or an amber alert that hopefully somebody could get them. And the amber alert's proven incredibly effective. It's saved almost 1,000 children to date nationwide. It's almost 90% effective in having, you know, finding the person they're looking for. Incredibly popular. So it's something that works. So why not use it for adults? So Go ahead.
That's okay. Oh, and take us through what Texas then did. They made this clear alert system there. How does this work?
Sure. So it works very much like the Amber Alert system. There's a couple of nuances when you're dealing with adults, because we live in a free society and adults have a right not to be found if they don't want to be found. So it's nothing that's designed for, I can't find my, you know, boyfriend, he didn't show up, or you know, Janie didn't show up for church today, and she always comes to church. Where is she? Let's issue an alert. It's not for that. There's specific criteria, actionable data that you can use. So it has to be the person, you don't know where their whereabouts are for, and it's been less than 72 hours. There's been an eyewitness or some other provable thing that you've seen something, you know, video, something seen something that's not right. You have a known suspect in a known vehicle. So, and not just a red truck, but need to know the license plate. Or, so you know who it is who has taken somebody, and whether they've taken them for the purposes of domestic abuse or abduction or sex trafficking or whatever it may be isn't important. What's important is there's actionable data that you can get out to the public rapidly, so that then they can find those people, they can report them, and hopefully law enforcement can intervene and do something about it.
And who actually makes the call, okay, yes, this meets the threshold for this clear alert, which exists now in Texas, again, not here. Who makes that call to say, okay, we're putting out the alert?
So in Texas, it's the law enforcement agency where they're reporting it. It works very much. It's using the same infrastructure as the Amber Alert and Silver Alert. So, and then those alerts go out to the National Weather Service, so it can notify cell phones, to law enforcement, to the Lottery Commission, so they can put them up on the boards in the convenience stores all over the state. Also to banks. So if there's somebody in a bank drive-through, and they can notify them there. So really comprehensive way to get that information out for people to find.
Talking to Owen Robinson, columnist with the West Bend Daily News, about this idea of an alert system functioning kind of like an Amber Alert for kids, a Silver Alert for seniors, but for everybody in between. Texas has created this. It's called the Clear Alert System there. As far as you know, Owen, was Texas the first state to tackle something like this?
It, as far as I know what it is, I'm fairly certain it is. And remember, Texas was the one who pioneered the Amber Alert back in the day as well. So this isn't the new track for them, but it is something that does fill a gap. And I think we've recognized, both with the Amber Alert and then the Silver Alert, and there's alert for veterans now, and there's a couple of other versions of it now. We've recognized how effective this is to be able to locate people when we know there's some imminent danger to that person. So we know it's effective. We know it works. There's no reason we can't utilize that system for adults out there.
How long has this been, the Clear Alert now for adults, been in effect in Texas?
It's not in effect yet.
Oh, not yet.
It was signed into law on, it was signed into law on June 6th. It goes into effect September 1st.
Gotcha.
So it's just about to go into effect.
Now, you are calling on Wisconsin to do this, to enact this Clear Alert system. I don't think this is super on the radar yet, Owen, but have you heard other people talking about this or reacting to your idea?
A little bit. So I put it out there a couple weeks ago in a column I wrote for Conley Papers across the state, and I've spoken with one legislator who's considering sponsoring a bill. I think this is a great bill. You know, it's a nonpartisan effort that can go out and help hopefully save some adults who are in imminent danger. At least the Texas analysis shows it has zero fiscal impact to the state because the entire infrastructure is there. It's just how you're executing it. So there may be some education out there, but other than that, very, very little fiscal impact. I think this is something that the legislature and the governor can get behind to pass and do something great for the state.
As you say, this goes on the same infrastructure as Amber and Silver Alert. Do we have evidence as to whether, I mean, sometimes I'll say, we're a radio station, we play the Amber Alerts sometimes, and sometimes people complain, they think, oh, it's not in my area, I don't need to be hearing this because I'm nowhere near it. Is there a frustration or backlash that could lead people to ignore if we get too many alerts?
Well, I think that's where the criteria is critical, because that was one of the fears, I know, as they were working on this legislation in Texas, that if it's triggered too often, it just becomes background noise and people ignore it and it's no longer effective. So with the Amber Alert, they're very specific about the criteria for it. And for the Clear Alert, it would be the same, but even more so because they're adults. So that's where you have to have more actionable data. So, and that's really the key. It's something where there's an imminent threat of danger and there's actionable data so people can actually do something about it. So it's not, as I said, it's not look out for that, you know, a red pickup that might have an adult who's missing in it. It's something with a license plate, or you know who took the person and you know the area they're in. Those are the things that make it effective, but that also limits the number of times that you could actually use it. And again, the Amber Alert is, I think the last count I saw was like 954 kids that it has saved throughout its existence across the U.S. And that's a lot of lives saved by this process.
And Owen, how hopeful are you that Wisconsin and I suppose other states will pick up where Texas left off on this?
I think we've seen, the effectiveness is undeniable. I think where people get worried is certainly concerned about, specifically with adults and their civil liberties and ensuring that we don't have a case where it's being abused or where it's being used so much that it becomes ineffective. So I think having those really tight criteria to make sure that it's used when somebody is in imminent danger and it's actionable, I think it's a no-brainer. And I really hope Wisconsin becomes the second state in the nation to pass it.
Owen, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for your listeners.
That's Owen Robinson, columnist with the West Bend Daily News and a blogger at bootsandsabers.com. We talked with him about his call for an emergency alert system for missing adults here in Wisconsin, modeled on something, as you just heard, that Texas has done. It goes into effect next month, the beginning of September. Now we're interested in hearing from you. What do you think of this idea? Should Wisconsin have something like this Clear Alert system for adults, something similar to an Amber Alert or a Silver Alert system, that Amber Alert for kids, Silver Alert for seniors? You can let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. And we're also interested in hearing if you've had an experience yourself with the Amber or Silver Alert systems here in Wisconsin, whether reporting it, if you're in law enforcement and you've issued one of these, if a loved one has been found using the Silver or Amber Alert systems. Share your story of how that worked out for you, what you think of the system, maybe how you think it might have worked a little better, if there is room for improvement. Again, tweet us at Central Time WPR or email your story, ideas@WPR.org. And of course, as always, you can message us at the Ideas Network via Facebook. Just head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and send us a message there. All right, get this, people. There's a whole new kind of blood-sucking leech living in the swamps around our nation's capital. Oh, I'm not making a political statement here. There's actually a newly discovered species of leech that actually lives in the actual swamps near Washington, D.C. As published in the Journal of Parasitology and reported by the Smithsonian Magazine, researchers back in 2015 were out in swamps collecting specimens. Let me stop there to talk about how they did this. Scientists, quote, were standing in slow-moving swamp water, letting leeches latch onto their bare legs, or gathering them up in nets from muddy pond bottoms. I think I'd go with the nets myself. Thanks. Anyhow, fast forward to this month, the researchers have compared, searched, gene sequenced, and so on, and figured out that, hey, they had found a previously unclassified species of leech. It's named Macrobdella mimicus because it mimics another kind of leech. That's the first newly classified leech species in North America in 40 years. Now, here's the description if you're out leech searching. I'm quoting here. The leech is olive green with orange spots, about as long as a cigarette and as wide as two cigarettes. It has three jaws, each containing 56 to 59 teeth, which can use to bite and siphon blood from humans. Leeches like this species can suck 2 to 5 times their body weight in blood, thanks to expandable pockets in their intestines. It's a living. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.